Pay attention. How many times can you tell your child to pay attention before they finally get the message? For some parents and teachers, it feels endless. But paying attention is not as simple as it seems. And today, we are going to explore ADHD and attention, what's happening in the brain, what you can do to support your child with attention challenges, and how attention can be trained. This is LD Expert Live. Students with attention challenges may get up every morning determined to pay attention and get their work done and submit it on time, only to get to the end of the day and find first period's homework still sitting there, not completed. In spite of best intentions, intelligence, motivation, and effort, students with learning and attention challenges often disappoint themselves and their parents and their teachers. The good news is that both learning and attention challenges can be changed. Welcome to the LD Expert Podcast, your place for answers and solutions for dyslexia, learning, and attention challenges. I'm your host, Jill Stowell, founder of Stowell Learning Centers and author of a brand new book, Take the Stone Out of the Shoe, a must-have guide to understanding, supporting, and correcting dyslexia, learning, and attention challenges. This book will help you understand why some bright children and teens have more difficulty than expected in school. It provides simple, practical tools for supporting struggling students at home and in the classroom. Most importantly, it presents real solutions and the science behind them. Our guest today is Dr. Giancarlo Licata. You may remember him from our May 19th broadcast on sleep. He is back by popular demand. Dr. Licata is the founder of Vital Brain Training and Vital Head and Spinal Care, which is a brain-based health practice in Pasadena, California, focusing on brain-based tools to improve pain and performance. Vital was established in 2008 and has helped over 2,000 clients, including professional athletes from the NFL, Major League Baseball, and the NCAA. Dr. Licata and Vital have been featured on PBS, ABC, and WebMD. Welcome back, Dr. Licata.
Hello, good morning. Thank you. It's good to be here.
It is nice to have you. You know, when students struggle in school, the first thing that teachers see in the classroom is lack of attention. And now with distance learning, parents are getting a firsthand look at just how much their kids are struggling with attention. The thing that concerns me is that most people seem to think that attention symptoms automatically mean that you have ADHD and you need medication. You and I both have a little bit different view of attention, and I would love for you to just talk about what attention is and how we measure it.
Yeah, great. Well, you know, I'm a parent of three, and I understand. I find myself telling my kids all the time, you know, pay attention. I'm gonna start this 5-hour monologue on the value of, you know, hard work, and you know, in 2 seconds they're off, and they don't pay attention to me. So attention is a very powerful word, and we tend to throw it around, and it doesn't mean much because we can't land on a clear boundary as to what it means and what it doesn't mean, right? So, from a neurocognitive standpoint, attention is the ability to divert all of our resources of our brain to something, and it's either external, the show, or it's internal. It's my thoughts and my racing mind, what am I gonna make for breakfast this morning before my kids get up, right? Those are the things that demand my attention. And so in an external world, it has to do with my ability to, we break that down into two things. My ability to hold my awareness onto one thing and stop my tendency to jump to something else, right? So there's actually two components to my external attention. Hold my awareness on one thing and turn off my tendency to jump to something else, right? And so now the problem is, you know, we're usually defining attention or inattention by just our behavior, right? If my child can't pay attention at school, then I take them to the pediatrician, or I take them to a learning specialist or an educational therapist, and they seem to ask me a bunch of questions, and they say, well, does your child jitter when he's in class? Does he interrupt the teacher? Does he do these things? And if enough of the boxes get checked, well, now all of a sudden we slap a label on this child and we say, well, your new identity is that you have ADHD, right? And so that becomes a whole nother road that now parents find themselves on. And I think that what you're saying is that there's other roads, there's other ways to look at it. So I think, hope that should be enough to get this conversation going.
Yeah. You know, it's true. When kids are identified as having ADHD, a lot of times, then that just sort of becomes their identity in their whole family and in their classroom. Some students treat it like a crutch or an excuse, kind of, and sometimes parents and teachers then see that as a limiting factor or reason to have lower expectations for that student.
Yeah. 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 You know, I think as a parent, the only time I really care about my child's attention is when it impacts my child's behavior or performance, really. And so if my child is getting bad grades, I start worrying about his attention, right? Or if my child can't obey me when I'm, you know, at the grocery store and they're all over the place, well, now I get concerned about my child's attention. And so, you know, I try to get practical about this, and attention is something that, you know, why is my child not able to sit in class when the other kids are able to sit in class? Or why is my child not able to, you know, sit quietly and, you know, read a book when the other kids are able to do so? And so, so what that is it's a present level of function. Really, it's a current level of function. My child has these things that are turned on too high or too low. And the problem is the second we take them to get tested, and the second they give them this label, now what happens is this label gives me and my child, what you're saying, this permanent identity, right? So we're going from current level of function to now a permanent identity. Current level of function is, when it's hard for me to hold attention or resist impulses. The identity is, I have ADHD, right? I have attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, right? And so that's like, I have cancer, or I have Alzheimer's, right? It's a label that we now carry, and it shapes our whole identity. So to be able to extricate those two things is already the beginning of something that is very powerful, because you now have more choices as a parent, right? So yes, I think that's a really key principle. It's a very key thing as a parent that we want to be able to understand, because if it's an identity and it's now a disease, the same way that it falls in the same category as cancers or Alzheimer's, ADHD, Parkinson's, they all seem like they're in the same group. Well, now we tend to think, well, now I need a medication to match this disease. I need a medication to match this condition, right? It's a passive identity. And so now I'm not empowered. I need to take a medication to kind of help my child stay focused. And unfortunately, most of the time medication may not work, and that's another conversation. But if it does, it's essentially because what we're taking is a form of amphetamine. And an amphetamine is like speed. It's like these, and Ritalin is one version of it, and there are others. And it's designed to speed up the brain waves in a particular area of the brain that tend to go a little bit too low. And when they're a little bit too slow or low, we become a little bit lost in our thoughts. Or it's harder for us to kind of engage and hold our attention in a particular place, or resist our impulses to go somewhere else. And that speed, or that amphetamine, or that Ritalin, or whatever that is, now all of a sudden that helps speed up those brain waves in that one little area. And that allows us to kind of just be calmer, right? So for some children, it's magic. It's magic. But now, or that child now becomes dependent on that medication to feel normal again. And again, your amazing work, what we're trying to do too, is to say, look, let's have a different conversation. Let's take this from an identity to a present level of function. And if it's a present level of function, let's look at seeing if we can maybe identify what those areas are and help them in a way that's more natural or less dependent on medication. So we're not saying it's one or the other. We just think that maybe not everything should fall within the category of this is my identity, this is my condition, and I'm now a passive recipient of some medication that you're going to give me. So
right. And yeah. And I'm stuck like this. I can't do anything about it.
Right. So, right.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, a couple of times you've kind of alluded to something that that I find really interesting. So many kids who have attention challenges will be described as impulsive. And I would love for you to talk a little bit about, from a brain perspective, kind of what that means if we've got this impulsivity going on and low attention. You know, I find that a really interesting thing, and I think it adds some clarity.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm going to, for some of our parents who may have already have children who are diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, I'm going to classify it in the way that the DSM-5, the common way to diagnose ADHD is set up. And then I'll talk about looking at it from a performance way. If our child is diagnosed with ADHD, usually based on a checklist, behavior, right? There's no actual test, you know, functionally to see what's going on. Did we check enough boxes off the list? Then you've got it, right? That's first of all. But it seems like they subcategorize that into, do I have ADHD inattentive, meaning it's harder for me to hold my attention, or do I have ADHD impulsive hyperactive, right? I'm impulsive hyperactive. I'm just going all over the place. And we all have kids or know kids that are like that. They're just everywhere. Johnny, sit down. Johnny, sit down. Johnny, stop kicking your sister. Johnny, stop, you know, hanging on the chandelier. Johnny, stop, right? And so that's the impulsive hyperactive, right? And then some people, they diagnose them as having a little bit of both. I'm inattentive and I'm impulsive hyperactive, right? Now, okay, that's helpful. And they have medications to try to match that. Now, what we're looking at, though, is the impulsivity is oftentimes going to be driven by another part of the brain. And the impulsivity is a part that's just, it's go. It's when I'm interrupting you in the middle of a conversation. It's when I'm in the middle of something and I just need to get up and go do something else. And so it's a jumpiness. It's an inability to just be here. Right. And so, now, in the brain, that looks, there's certain regions of the brain around the midline, as well as in the front midline, that tends to make the brain, that tends to make us feel a little bit more jumpy, just going after it. Now, and so that's a different region of the brain than the part of our brain that can't, I can be present, but maybe I'm not paying attention to you. I can be present, but I'm not following what you're telling me, right? This is the child who's staying, they're sitting in their chair. They're cooperating, but you're like, okay, are you following me? Step, you know, point A, point B, point C, point D, and by point B, they're just somewhere else. Sometimes they're kind of in their brain and they're lost in thoughts or they're daydreaming, right? That's another part of attention that's not right. It's not performed well. It's not tuned in, but it's different than this impulsivity, right? And sometimes our kids have a little bit of both, right? So I don't know if that answers the question, but that impulsivity is something that is different than just the inattention. And sometimes our kids have a little bit of both of them in
their children. Right. And I know that you and I have collaborated a little bit, and it's been really interesting to me to get to see the brain mapping that you do with students. And you know, we have talked about the fact that sometimes with that impulsivity, they are trying so hard to pay attention, but they can't. And then if the attention part of the brain is low and impulse control is high, then you've got this kid that's working so hard and so exhausted by this, even though that may not be what it looks like on the outside, but that, you know, that the brain is actually working too hard to pay attention.
Oh yeah. Yes. It's something that we can see. And we'll probably, you know, we're already talking about brain maps, and I'll probably start defining that and set the stage for brain maps. Yes, there are a lot of kids who we will map, and we'll do also additional tests like an IVA 2 attention and impulse control test. And that's something that you do as well, I know. And we can see something called stamina. This is that kind of grit part of the brain. This is the kind of the ability of us to just push through, to just, this is not easy, but I'm going to keep going, right? And that's some of the exhaustion that we'll see in a child, where they're really trying hard. I mean, they're really trying to pay attention. They just can't. And so I say it's like you get this amazingly wonderful Rottweiler puppy, and it's just so strong and it's so powerful and it's pulling you all over the place, right? Or you know, so it's just I have a metaphor of just a very strong, poorly trained puppy that is dragging the owner everywhere all across the neighborhood. And that's what sometimes our brains or our children's brains feel like. And now the problem is that child isn't they're not being disobedient, right? They're not trying to get in trouble. They're not trying to do the opposite of what you want them to do. Their little puppy, right, is out of control. It's not able to be trained. And so we can try to drug the puppy. Okay, that's one way to do it. But what if we can identify what the puppy's doing, identify where it is, and begin to train it in a way that's a little bit more humane, a little bit more compassionate, there's a little bit more wisdom to it. That's what we're trying to do. And that's what you do so well as well.
And we are going to talk about that in more depth a little bit later, because I just think it's so important for people to understand that there are many ways to look at these things. Yeah. So I know when we have talked before, you've talked about how there are some things that can disrupt attention or even mimic attention challenges, things that are going on that. So now it looks like the child has ADHD.
Right. And so, so we set the stage for this conversation around the attention is not necessarily a disease. It's more of things that are functioning too high or too low. And we identified already a few different things, like my ability to hold attention, my ability to resist the puppy, the impulses. Now, the challenge is when I just go back on that list and I start checking off behaviors, the problem is there are other things that will mimic those two regions of the brain that will cause the person to check off something off the list. Right. And so let's say so what are the imposters that get in the way of our ability to pay attention? Right. Internal anxiety and rumination will look like inattention. Right. And I'm sure we've done it before. Right. Our spouse is talking to us and they're telling us about their day. And all of a sudden we're here just really worrying, just really racking our brains on something. And sometimes it's on loop. It's not necessarily like we're making any progress on it. We just somehow feel the need to kind of keep going it over and over and over again. Well, that's the anterior cingulate of the brain. It's what the brain does. And if that's kind of on overdrive, on overactive, it will look like I'm not paying attention to my spouse. Like I don't care. And of course the spouse is telling themselves the story of they never care about what I have to say. They don't care about my day. It's whatever their life is more important than mine. But in my brain, what's mimicking inattention is this internal anxiety kind of hamster wheel, right? And so when we brain map, we can see regions of the brain that are doing that. They're overactive. It's front midline. We can see it on a map. And it's very high in what we call high betas. And I'm now throwing terms that I'll define in a second. But the whole point is our child is really dealing with a form of again, it's not a good word, but kind of an anxiety, right? It's a, it's an over stress. It's an overstimulation. It's an internal kind of suffering, really. And now we're yelling at them because they're not paying attention to the teacher. And so the child is stressed. The child feels anxious. The child's ruminating. And then the teacher's saying, well, what's Bobby? What's the square root of 64? And Bobby's not paying attention. Right. And so it's like, Bobby's never paying attention. It's always the same thing. I call on him and he's just never responding. He's always like, what, where, why? Right. And so that's a mimicker. It mimics the inability to pay attention, but really it's a rumination. It's an anxiety. Mm-hmm. It's stress. Okay. So that's one. That's one. And that's, and I think we had, you know, we work with Soul Learning Centers. We have clients in common. And that was a common thing that one client who had a form of inattention, that was something we saw on the brain map. And that was something we were able to help train a little bit. Mm-hmm. And we saw how all of a sudden Bobby was able to pay more attention to what's interacting right in front of them because they're not stuck in their little world, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's, I think we kind of forget as we go through our day-to-day existence that there's a lot more to what we see. I mean, what's going on in the brain is pretty profound, actually. But a lot of times kids who have attention challenges, they move or they tap or they click their pen and it drives everybody crazy. Yeah. But, you know, that could actually be something that they're doing to try to calm themselves.
Yeah. It's interesting. And there are two kind of versions of that we see or that we know about. I'm sure there are more. And so there's moving and tapping. Sometimes we do to calm, right? When my wife knows that I'm overly stimulated about something, I'm stressed out about something, I'm really trying to, you know, it's getting me all worked up. She knows because my leg's just going, right? My leg is just moving all over the place. And so what I'm trying to do is down-regulate my nervous system through movement, right? Movement ends up being a little bit of a down. Well, it can down or up-regulate our mm-hmm. body. I'm going to give two examples. And so one of them we know about is when we're trying to down-regulate. And so there are certain kids that, again, they're dealing with stress, and we're going to call this stress, but just stressful homes, stressful, you know, parents are fighting. Maybe parents are going through a divorce. Maybe, you know, their older brother or sister is dealing with some kind of drugs or issues of teenage years. Corona and the kids' whole worlds are just seems like everything is falling apart. And so what happens is they feel very, very over aroused, and aroused not in the fancy word of or fancy way of the word, but aroused like my nervous system is just tuned up too high. And so movement ends up being a way to kind of lower that arousal. It's trying to regulate a little bit, right? Yeah. So now the child, really the solution for that child is to help that child feel reconnected, to feel more regulated, right? And so the solution is not gonna be to drug the child. And in fact, that child we give certain medications to and they're gonna feel even more. And they may feel like they can focus, but they'll have such an increased level of anxiety inside of them that, yeah, they're getting better grades, but really probably their quality of life may not be much better. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's movement to downregulate, there's also movement to upregulate. And so there, think about if you're driving long hours at night and you've got another 2 hours to go and you're falling asleep at the wheel, right? What will we tend to do? We'll tend to open the windows. We'll tend to bring the radio really loud. We'll tend to start moving around, right? Because what we're actually trying to do is we're trying to upregulate our body. We're trying to get our nervous system to be more aroused because it's not aroused enough. It's not tuned up high enough. And so sometimes we'll see kids who are just kind of falling asleep or they're just kind of not there. And all of a sudden you just see them, okay, all right. And they're just moving all over the place. Well, they're trying to upregulate. Now there's the whole point. There are other ways to do it. There are ways to do it. If you can identify what it is, there's other tools. There's other tools that you can do to do that. So,
right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. You know, another impersonator of attention challenges is what we see all the time with our struggling learners is weak underlying skills, weak auditory processing or visual disorientation on the page or difficult, slow processing speed. I mean, there are just so many underlying pieces to learning, foundational skills that help us to be efficient learners. And we think about, most people think about learning as reading and academics and math. And that is the tip of the iceberg, but underneath it, there are all kinds of skills that support that. And if any of those underlying skills are weak, then it can cause a student, it will impact a student's attention. And so, you know, the vast majority of the students who come to us at the Learning Center initially, you know, look like they have attention challenges. Mm-hmm. But once those underlying skills are developed, the attention symptoms often disappear right along with, you know, the increased success at school. However, there are a lot of components to attention, and sometimes attention really is the root cause of the student struggles in school. And you've kind of alluded to this, that attention can be trained. We both know that, and we've worked together with some students on it. And so I definitely want to talk about it. Before we do that, though, what are some things that parents can do to help their struggling students with attention? Just some day-to-day things.
Some day-to-day things. Yes. So what's interesting about this, so let's use the arousal challenge. One of the things we saw, and everyone can tune back to our sleep episode that happened back in May. What's fascinating about the brain is that if we don't get good sleep, we will start to have, our brain will start to be under aroused. And we'll function more on a theta, and so we'll go into that, a theta brainwave state, which will cause us to be, we'll tend to be more inattentive. I mean, it's a very, on so many levels, poor sleep will create more inattention as well as more mimickers of inattention. Okay, so so sleep, that's a big thing. And so what can a parent do? A parent can try to have good, healthy sleep habits for their child. A parent can set some compassionate yet clear boundaries for their child's sleep schedule, right? And so so sleep is one, when we can go deeper into sleep. Another one, though, is our food. So I'll go into the story about food, but if our child's brain is going through the sugar roller coaster, we eat something that turns into sugar or is sugar, we get a huge boost of too much blood sugar in our brain. Our brain becomes over-aroused, and then our body tries to say, no, that's way too much, and it releases all this insulin, and then it takes all that blood, all that sugar out of the blood, stores it in our fat cells, and then we get this crash. Right. And so what happens when Bobby has, fruity pebbles, two bowls with some orange juice that's the equivalent of maybe about, 80 to 90 grams of sugar. All of a sudden, by the time Bobby gets on the bus or is in the car and ready to kind of drive into school, Bobby's going to be all over the place. Bobby wants to jump out the window and run alongside the car because Bobby has so much energy. Now, that's not a brain that can actually focus. That's over-aroused, right? Now, the problem is by the time Bobby finally says hi to his friends, puts his backpack down in the classroom and sits down in his desk, now that's right about the timing that the insulin did its job and all the sugar is running out of the blood, and the brain now just has nothing left, right? And so now that's not an intention problem. That's a diet problem, meaning that's my food is sabotaging me. And what a parent can do is, pick our battles, but have a compassionate you know, food boundaries and understand what food does to us, both in the short term and the long term. And sugar is going to be a saboteur of good attention, right?
Right.
So sleep and food, I think, are going to be big ones. And then the third one is going to be that emotional connection that when we lack it, that attachment that so many great speakers talk about, that attachment to the parent, that sense of safety and calmness, and you know, maybe the world is falling apart, but at least my little world at home is okay. That attachment will also become powerful, and many of the behaviors that we tend to associate with inattention start to settle down, right? And so what we want to do is, at the very least, we can do that. Like, we can start there, right? And so those are important tips.
Great. And, you know, just going back to food just a little bit, because our kids are heading back to school, whether it's at home or at school, giving your child protein for breakfast will help the brain to have the energy that it needs, you know, to learn. So,
Yes, no, you're absolutely right. You know, our food, so the brain really needs more a consistent stream of energy, just consistent. That's what it wants. Now, we can still have little highs and lows, but we need a good consistent amount. So I say it's like a good drummer on a band, right? Like, you just need somebody holding a certain beat, just hold the rhythm, right? And so good proteins, and believe it or not, this is, you know, it used to be controversial. It's not anymore. The science is very clear on it. Good, healthy fats become really great, consistent energy sources for the brain and for the body, really. And so if we have something like the good traditional farmer's breakfast, believe it or not, maybe some bacon, some avocado, have some veggies in there, but, you know, an egg or two. Believe it or not, at the end of the day, your child will be better off during that day and overall health if they had that versus, again, the sugary cereal drinks with sugary OJ or whatever they're having, because they're getting that consistency, they're getting that, and parents oftentimes think, well, oh my gosh, no, that was supposed to be bad. Remember, the Heart Association said that fats are bad. I mean, from 2008, there's been an overwhelming amount of evidence showing that, no, you know, fats are not bad. Fats are necessary for the body. You know, too much inflammation can create good fats to become bad. But really what creates the inflammation is sugar. It's the sugar is the main inflammator of the brain, if that was a word. And so, you know, we're not doing our kids harm if we give them some good, consistent proteins and fats. But again, we don't want to take the fats out. I think it's almost impossible to have that consistency without healthy, good oils and fats. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah, it can be very confusing. So many conflicting messages. But, you know, I think we all do basically know that sleep and diet and, of course, movement and water are critical to brain health, thinking, memory, and attention, but it's still hard to make changes. So just putting a little understanding under it, I think, really, really helps. We've been talking about attention, and I'm going to give you some quick takeaways because we explored a lot of things. First of all, poor attention can be a symptom of the learning problem, or it can be the cause of the learning problem. And at Stowell Learning Centers, that's one of the things that we have to sort out in our assessment, because the training is going to look different depending on what the real issue is. Number two, attention is not an all or nothing issue. There are many different components of attention, and any one person can have some attention strengths and some weak areas. Sleep, low sugar intake, diet, and a calm environment will support your child's attention. And attention and the components of attention can be trained. Dr. Licata, it is always great to have you on the show. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here with us today.
Always a pleasure.